session number 11210, reel 6.
Reel 6. You mentioned earlier, Mr. Watcham, that there were two Jewish soldiers in the camp. Were there any indications that they were treated in any different form than the rest of the troops?
Not really. We emphasised the fact that as long as they wore British uniform and had a British pay book, they were reasonably safe. One did have arguments with this same helpman, but there was no maltreatment of them. The other one was an Irish Jew, actually. I remember his name, Cahill, Paddy Cahill, came from Belfast. And I don't know whether you may have heard of this Blue Army. You know, the Germans came round and asked for volunteers to join this special brigade, which was to fight the Russians. This was against communism. And they went round all the prison camps and asked for volunteers. They were promised everything, almost promised them the moon. But they were told they wouldn't be fighting the British and their own countrymen or the Americans. And this was purely a fight against the Russians. And every year this, I think he was called Berlin Joe, if I remember, he used to come round the camps asking for volunteers. And they used to pick on the Irish, thinking, you know, here we have people who might just do it. And this Paddy Cahill was a bit of a weak character in that sense. And I know when they were interviewed, the men used to get around Paddy, and I think he was more afraid of his fellow Irishmen than he was of the Germans, telling him not to weaken, not to give in. But nobody ever went from our camp. But every time, you know, they used to come around and get volunteers.
Were you subjected over your POW life to any kind of indoctrination?
Not really. In the first camp where we did have, can I tell you a story from the first camp? One of our regular soldiers, when we were out on working parties, the Schachtmeister had his own little, almost like a caravan place, you know. And this morning, the whole of it was frosted over. And this Tommy went and wrote Heil Churchill on it. But he didn't realise that when the frost melted, it would have been icy. It had taken the paint off. And of course, we were all paraded in the square. And this German officer came and gave us a lecture on Churchill. Why, you know, he was the enemy, not Hitler. Or just really rubbing it in about poor old Churchill, you know, and blaming him for the war and telling us we should have been friends with the Germans. But this was about the only time we were ever seriously indoctrinated.
Was there any special attempts or ongoing attempts to needle the Germans in various ways?
Oh, there was always little bits of sabotage going on. I wouldn't say needle, but I'll give you one instance of, we had one chap in this camp who absolutely hated Germans. He made no bones about it. And he never learned any German at all. Most of them men could speak a few words. The only words he knew was Nichtverstehen, which was very handy.
What is that?
I don't understand. And
what was his name? Do you recall?
Oh, I can't remember. He was a Cockney, I can remember that. And he flatly refused. He said he wanted to work for the Germans either. And what he did was very ingenious. He got a plank of wood, but nobody dared touch it. That was his. All that man did, as far as I know, because I wasn't up in the works, all he did was walk around with a plank of wood on his shoulder. And if a German guard stopped him, or a foreman, and asked him, you know, where are you going or what are you doing, he just pointed this bit of wood and said, Nicht verstehen. And he never did a stroke of work in 2 years. That was all he did. That's, you know, and of course that was a great fillip to the rest of the fellows.
What about baiting? Was there any baiting going on?
Well, some of the guards we found were a little bit tough, you know, so you either avoided them or you, you stood up to them as best you could, but you had to be very careful. And don't forget, we've been prisoners now three and a half years, you know, you don't want to get yourself shot for a stupid little argument sort of thing. There were arguments and differences, but nothing...
But nobody was seriously hurt.
Well, by this time, a lot of the men were getting tired being on the same commando 3 years, and a lot of chaps escaped because the rule was 99 times out of 100, you were never sent back to the camp. So if you wanted to change camps, you escaped. But this meant time and wastage from the German point of view, and they got really tough about this. And they threatened, you know, you'd be shot on sight and all this and the other. So escapes were pretty dangerous things to undertake. One of my friends escaped. The very man, I think I mentioned right at the very beginning, who was captured with me and who shared a tin of sardines with me, Lincoln, and he still was called Lincoln with me. And he came to me one day and he gave me all his personal belongings and he asked me to look after him in case, you know. And he'd watched, he was with this German, as a sort of an apprentice, you might say, and he'd noticed this man had the same routine every morning. He came in, leaned his bicycle up against the wall, went to his locker, got his dungarees out, and then always went to the toilet. So this fella nicked his bicycle and just pedalled off. And he rode for miles and miles and miles and miles. Nobody challenged him. And he came to this river where the bridges were down. So he threw the bike in the river and there was a rowing boat to take him across. And he kept going and, you know, but he didn't know where he was really going because escape was fairly difficult. And in the end, in sheer hunger, both of them, he gave himself up. And it took him a long time to convince them that he was an escape prisoner. But they always carried the discipline, you see.
And did he come back to you after the escape, this chap?
No. And you know, his punishment wasn't so much for the escaping. The punishment was for the bicycle, sabotage.
Did he tell you what his punishment was?
He got 21 days in the bunker. No, I think I'm not sure whether he came back or not. I think he did, yes, because this was almost before we packed in.
What kind of escape methods were used?
Well, that one was merely observing and taking his chance. Some people went over the wire, of course, but not many. You know, some of the films you see, you know, tunnelling and that, I never saw any evidence of that.
There was no tunnelling?
Well, as I said before, I'm not condemning but these officers were sitting in the camp all day. They were bored to tears. And let's be honest about it, I think I'm right in saying in later years they were well organised, there were contacts and they were trained in there. You see, we were captured very early on in the war, and when you're working, say, 10, 12 hours a day, you were jolly glad to get back at night. The escapes were mostly off working parties, you know, out in the woods or somewhere like that. Men would nick off, sort of thing. But planned escapes, I didn't see a lot of evidence of it. No. And as I say, where were you going to go? Unless you had contacts. We didn't know if there was any Polish underground or anything. The Poles that we worked alongside were absolutely subjugated. I mean, they were worse off than we were. So any resistance movements, we didn't know anything about them.
Were you witness to any cruelties to the surrounding population?
Oh, I've seen Poles beaten up on several occasions in front of us. And I remember one, and I often quote this, out on the first camp I was in, way out in the woods on this working party, we suddenly saw these women, shaven heads, and you know, these long stripes, well, what could you call them? Dresses they wore. These were Polish prisoners, criminals, or whatever you want to call them, with women guards. Dreadful, just reminding you of, you know, we didn't realize then, but afterwards we realized this, they were concentration camp workers. There must have been some small concentration camp nearby. And they didn't even look, you know, because some of the boys, wolf, you know, typical Tommies, of course, but these women didn't even look at them. Hard, stone-faced guard.
The lack of women, you know, in the camps, and that did that in any way lead to any problems?
Oh, there were lots of problems. Not to any great degree. When we did any plays, you know, there were female parts. Obviously, someone had to duff in and play these female parts, but some men were approached, but there was nothing really, nothing serious.
No homosexual.
No, not on any large scale. It would be there, I'm nearly sure, but not to any, not to a degree that either we had to complain to the Germans, which we, I don't suppose we would. But there were actual relationships outside camps later on.
How did they come about?
There was one classic, as far as I, and I'm almost sure it's true. I don't know whether. Well, anyway, I was sent for by the camp commandant this day. It was a new camp commandant. And he just looked at me and he said, "I'll give you 2 hours to get him back in again." That was all he said to me. And I looked at him and, you know, initially I didn't understand. 2 hours, he said. Well, one of our chaps was nicking the wires regularly. And we understand, mind, I can't corroborate this, but he was apprenticed or assigned to the blacksmith, who was one of the local brown shirt party leaders. And we noticed every Sunday this man used to strut past the camp in the stiefels, you know, and the brown peak cap, the swastika, you know. And apparently our English friend was nipping up and spending the afternoon with his wife. If it had been found out, I don't know what would have happened. I don't think they dare even make it public, because to think that a brown shirt's wife was consorting with a Tommy, well.
So when he said to you, 2 hours to get him back, what was he telling you to go and get him? Seek
go
him?
And get him in.
So where did you find him?
He was up in the works, because this blacksmith lived up in there. Oh, no, you see, there were a lot of young girls working up in there. I don't think there were any physical relationships, because that was pretty Danish, but there were little love matches, I'm sure. I can't prove this entirely. I know when the camp broke up, I was left behind, and going round the huts and trying to check what was left, because the men had to leave in a hurry. I came across this young girl who had a pistol in her ring, a small revolver in her hand, and she was looking for a boyfriend. But he'd gone. But they were only very small. We were pretty well guarded from that point of view, and it was very, very.
What
difficult.
Would you say were the essential features of in keeping up your morale?
Well, of course, many of us, we got fairly frequent letters from home, and as I say, I read the papers and I listened to the radio, and I heard snippets of news, and we knew that the war was going better for us. I heard about the invasion 6 hours after it happened. The Feldwebel sent for me, and I remember he looked at me and, what was he said? Feel blood, feel vergessen or forgotten. A lot of blood will be shed. He was telling me all about this. And the Russians were getting nearer. He was a very dramatic man. I remember he laid 3 kugel, 3 bullets. He laid them on the desk, and that one for himself, one for his wife, one for his child, if the Russians came. They were absolutely petrified, terrified by the Russians.
What was his name?
Hans Hager. Hmm?
This is the gentleman who became your friend?
Yeah. Well, that's a long story. That I didn't write to him originally. He'd made friends with one of our camp men, and I was asked to write back to him. That's how it started. But they were terrified of the Russians. Because, you see, I understand going into Russia, they had this burnt waste policy, and they had really gone to town with the Russians. So they knew what was facing them when the tide turned, and it did, of course.
Was there a growth of, well, I suppose, what you might call a prisoner of war mentality over the years?
Oh, yes. We had our own language, for example. The Feldwebel was the bubble, and some of them had a non-smoke, where you weren't allowed to smoke, or you were, you know, they had their own secret words. We had our own flash club. Oh, we had all sorts of,
you know,
we call it the flash club. This was a means of raising money for charity. And you had to, if a man came up to you and said flash, you had to produce your little disc, your flash. And if you hadn't got it on, you would find a cigarette or a 10 pennies. Just, or a little whatever, you know. These are all homemade things, you see. I mean, a chap would go down to the cookhouse for his mucker, and then we'd come out with two bowls of soup, and somebody would go, shout, flash. What do you do with two bowls of soup? And you had to count to 10, you see. It sounds stupid now, but it was a way of relieving boredom. And
You say that you were raising money for charity. What charities were you raising money for?
Well, I mean, for the Red Cross, probably, or something like that, you see. Or just, you know, chap would say, well, it costs you a cigarette or something like that, you see.
Well, haven't talked about Red Cross inspections. Did they come at a regular interval where they actually inspected and gave you the chance to air your criticism or complaints?
Only once did I ever encounter anybody, and it was in the first camp, so I wasn't directly dealing with them. When I was interpreter, we didn't have anybody come around from the International Red Cross. I remember one day, one of these commanders came in to pick Red Cross up, and when this, it was always a horse-drawn cart, of course, and as he got near it, this fellow looked 70 if he was a day, and Hans was standing next to me, and he said, "That's an old man there." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Bring him to me." So I told this chap, I said, "The German Feldwebel would like to see you." I'll not tell you what he said, of course. And he came from Northumberland, from Choppington or somewhere, if you know the dialect, a pretty broad dialect in Northumberland Fusiliers, I think. And he'd been in the First World War. And Hans couldn't get over this old man. He gave him a little cigar. And this old man, I got chatting, because being a Durham lad, you know, we had a little bit in common, and I said, "I felt they was very interested in you." He says, "Tell me." He says, "He must have been the bugger I missed in the First World War." I said, "Do you want me to tell him that?" He says, "Aye, go on, tell." So I told Hans this. Well, the Germans have a funny sense of humour, saying, but he thought it was quite funny. And they began to chat in pidgin German and with me interpreting. And, you know, by the time they were finished, it sounded to me as all they'd almost lain up at each other in the First World War. And every time he came in, it was always the alter man, the old man, and he always gave him a little...
Can you just explain these commandos that you talk about coming in? I assume that these are camps in working. The area.
Yes, small working parties, we call them.
And they came in and collected their cross parties from your base.
From the depot,
and took
yes.
Them out.
That was another contact sometime. They would have snippets of news for us, you see. The other thing that amused me, we got a change of English commandant, and we got a Scotsman from Aberdeen, Peter Head. A real nice fellow he was. I got on all right with him. But they wore these cutaway jackets and trews, you know. I think it was the Cameroonians, I'm not sure. And this day we noticed the Germans were in panic stations, and we found out that this very high-ranking officer was coming to visit the camp. So they were polishing, you know, spit and polish, as we would say. Duly arrived, came into the camp. Now, whether this upset them, I really don't know, but I always had to report as the interpreter, you know, give them the name of the camp and who I was and the camp commander. Well, this Scotchman was standing there and he had a button loose. And this German officer leaned forward and pointed that he had a button loose. This Scot shook hands with him. Can you imagine? To think that a German officer, high ranking German officer, that a Tommy would shake hands on. He didn't blow his top, he didn't say anything, but you could see by the look on his face he was totally disgusted, and he just turned around and stormed out of the camp, much to the delight, I might add, of the German guards. But we never saw him again. Now, whether he was really upset, I don't know, but that was the end of it. But if you'd seen, you know, the stupid man should have given the command, you had buttons to, but he started to point to him, of course. He thought he wanted to shake hands.
Do you recall the name of the Scot?
No, I can't remember. It might be in my book, but I really don't remember. I think he said he was the postmaster in Peterhead. I think he said he was. He was the man that made the plum duff, you know.
Do you recall any particular parades that you had to attend in camps?
Sunday morning.
Were there any annual?
No, Hitler's birthday. We always got a bottle of beer on Hitler's birthday, I remember, in the first camp. And we prayed it every Sunday, of course.
Was this a church parade?
No, just an inspection. The funny thing was, by this time, you know, we'd been issued with new uniforms. And I know when I used to go down into town, you know, with the German guards, I was immaculately dressed. I was new uniform. And the poor old German guard, you know, the changes that came out were quite remarkable. And we noticed these. When I used to go into the town, I used to always look around the shops very carefully, because they had their propaganda ways. And if on the door or the counter of the shop, they had a thing, nicht fragen, nicht klagen, sondern England schlagen. If you saw that, you knew you were in a hostile shop, sort of thing. Nicht fragen means don't ask any questions, nicht klagen, don't grumble and complain, don't knock the living deal out of England, schlagen, beat England. So you don't ask questions, don't complain. Let's get on and beat English. So if you saw that, you knew you were in an alien shop. But I used to go in, the Germans didn't know I could speak German. And it was very, very upsetting sometimes, because you felt almost at home. The German Fraus would come in, typical, just like at home, with shopping baskets and shuffling along, you know, and muttering and talking away. And of course, I could understand them. And I remember one day, they were all talking away. Some things they were saying were complimentary, others weren't. So I just walked between them and I said, "Entschuldigung, Sie mir, excuse me." Of course, they realised I could speak German. And one of them came up to me afterwards and said, "Could you tell me how her boy was? You see, he was a prisoner in England." And I had to tell her, I can't remember the name of the camp, but it was somewhere in the south of England. Oh, I said, he'd be all right there. But you see, there was a German mother worried about a boy away, you know, same as myself. Probably she saw in me her own son, you see. Because they suffered, let's be honest about it.
Were there any signs, with you having this job, in effect, of being able to move around the area, were there any signs at any time that they, you know, hated you?
I never found it, no. No. The fact that I could speak German was a big help. I think they appreciate the fact that they've taken the trouble to learn their own language. And by this time, they'd had it. They were getting war-weary. So after all, you know, the war was nearly 4 to 5 years on, and the Russians were getting ever nearer, and the D-Day landings had happened, you know. The swing, the reverse was happening now, and the bombing. I mean, I can't believe it, but I saw this with my own eyes, bombers coming over, right right over that. We didn't expect them to come that far, but there was a big Focke Wulf factory not far away from us, I understand. It's a very funny feeling, you know, to be sitting there watching your, well, these were American bombers, and you see one hit, you know, think they're your boys, you know, or your allies. And then you'd see the parachutes open, and we couldn't see this plane coming down. Terrible.
Did this have effect on overall morale?
Well, it boosted us tremendously.
Oh, I haven't asked you about the religious aspect of life in the camps. How was religion dealt with, and how was your religious aspect dealt with?
Well, we were visited by padres who were prisoners. The Roman Catholic, strange enough, was a real buoyant character, ginger-haired fellow. I remember he didn't come in through the door, he jumped in through the window. I always remember this, and we were quite impressed with this fellow. And he didn't pump religion into us. He was more interested in our welfare, this and the other. Then we had a Church of England man who came and he took a service. And I think we had one or two men who were probably lay preachers in the Methodists who used to conduct little services on a Sunday.
Was religion important, the religious belief?
I can say this now you've asked the question, but when I was released, when the Americans finally got to us, is this an appropriate time? Probably is. You might think this is very sentimental, but two things happened to me. The first thing I did, we were on a German Luftwaffe aerodrome, an Air Force aerodrome, and I was in the officer's quarters, and I found this bucket of briquettes, and I remember lighting this fire, and the first thing I did, I had a hot bath. Because we just watched 1,100 miles out of Poland, so you can imagine the state. Really lovely. It was top of luxury with a capital L. And then on the aerodrome, there was a small chapel. And I went in there, and I knelt down, and I gave thanks. Now, you might think that very sentimental, but I really did. I went in there, and I gave thanks for my safe delivery. Actually, I've written an article about this in a church magazine, and it was printed nationwide, because while I was kneeling there, I looked up, and on the walls were these different insignias and paintings, and you know, a typical church, and I can remember seeing the name of Immelmann. Now, I don't know if you know Immelmann. He was a very famous German aviator, and Richthofen. And I just thought afterwards, there I was in this little chapel, giving thanks and praying to my God. And there were the Germans doing exactly the same thing, praying for victory, heroes worshipped. It really came home to me. It was a most peculiar moment for me. I'd been a prisoner 5 years. I was literally free in that sense. In a very bad state, I might add, you know, I'd lost an awful lot of weight and hungry. But it was a wonderful moment, a really wonderful moment. And it contrasted, funny enough, you know how your mind, things flash in front of your mind. It took me back 5 years to the last time I took communion in France. And this man, this padre came around and asked if anybody wanted to take communion. And I was only one of them, there were only a few. And communion was 5 bales of hay stacked with a cross on the top in this farm, with cockerels and hens crowing all around. Fantastic. But I always remember that was the last time I took communion. And then 5 years later.
Padres coming in, they weren't with you. Were they coming in from other camps?
They would be based in the Stalag, you see, and they would have permission to visit various camps and commanders, you see. And nobody came to the second camp, as far as I can remember. But certainly in the first camp, we had visits.
The Germans, towards the end of your internment, would obviously be even more so showing signs of breaking down.
Well,
was this evident to you?
Yes. I was sent for about 2 or 3 weeks before, and I was given a warning then. They were on this alert system, purple, almost like the ERP in this country, you know, different colours, and told, you know, we knew the Russians were very close. And funny enough, I the phone went one day, and I was on my own, and I picked this phone up and it answered. Now, you see, my German wasn't perfect. Don't get me... I mean, I wasn't absolutely fluent in German. But many of the Folkdeutsch and the Poles spoke a bastard kind of German. So that I could get away as a Folkdeutscher, you see. And this officer was talking to me and it asked me where this camp was. And I told him everything, you see. And the significance of that would come out later. I think it was about January the 3rd, 4th, I was sent for.
What year was this?
45. This was the end, as far as it. And the Germans, the commandant told me that the Russians had overrun the Tannenberg Memorial, which is in East Prussia, and that was only 20 or 30 miles away, which in modern warfare wasn't very, very far. And I was to give the order that the camp was to be evacuated. And the men were told to take what food and clothing they could with them. Now, this was January 4th, it's the middle of winter, and you can imagine how cold it was. Minus 10, 15, 20 outside. It was quite common. So the men smashed wardrobe, cupboards up, and also made sledges and packed all sorts of things, you know, to get away. And the commandant said to me, he said, but you can't go. You have to stay behind. But you can choose 5 volunteers to stay with you, your friends if you want to, which I did. And I learned that.